Okay, so this is an old talk. I'm going to show excerpts from this, but I'm happy to put these slides up on the wiki space also. So what I plan to show, if we're interested, is how you can approximate these eigenvalues, eigenfunctions, and these modes directly from data, and then maybe some examples of people are interested in how to use these to analyze dynamical systems. So I hope that John will... understand
transferring this.
Something from this. So, okay. So first, let me say what this dynamic mode decomposition is. So this is something that Peter Schmid came up with in 2008. And here's what the procedure looks like. So you gather a bunch of snapshots from some system you want to analyze, and these are supposed to be equally spaced in time. So imagine this could be like in a fluid setting, X naught is like a PIV flow field at time zero. X1 is a PIV flow field at the next time step. So you get a bunch of these time steps. And then you make this assumption, which sounds like a stretch, but you assume that these are linearly related. So there's some linear operator that relates the present time step to the next time step. And this you might object to. But the context in which he was thinking was kind of this global stability. You want to look for eigenfunctions in which there is like a linearization. You're going to try to find the eigenvalues and eigenvectors or eigenfunctions of that linearized operator.
And the operator is constant, so it doesn't depend on K.
Right, yeah, that's important. Yep, the operator is constant. Okay, and the way DMD works is you use an Arnoldi-like algorithm. So all that is you say you have a Krylov subspace, so I'll just... maybe use the board for a second. Most people probably know what a Krylov subspace is, but if not, it's just a subspace spanned by some vector x and then ax and then a squared x up to, say, a n minus 1x. So you get an n minus 1 dimensional subspace, and you try to find the eigenvectors of A projected onto the subspace. And there are numerical methods for doing that. So, okay, we don't know what A is, but we know what X is. And if X1 is just AX, we know AX. We know A squared X up to AN minus 1X. So the idea is we have kind of this expression for the subspace, so you use an Arnoldi-like algorithm. So with these algorithms, A is often so big you don't want to store it in your computer, so you pretend that you can't actually access A. You can only access A acting on a vector. Well, we have A acting on every vector in the subspace there from our data. So that's the essence of what DMD was doing. Okay, so I mean, there's a hitch that typically the dynamics are nonlinear and this linear assumption doesn't hold. That's not the main point of what I want to get at here. So here's an alternative way, or I should get the light, thinking about DMD. It's just a bit more general and fits better into this Koopman picture. So we're going to gather some snapshots of data, x1 through xm, and then corresponding snapshots one time step later. So the idea is x1 is a flow field at one time, x1 sharp is the same flow field at the next time step. Okay, now maybe do a new simulation, and x2 is the initial condition of that simulation. x2 sharp is one step later, right? So it's clear that the previous is a special case of this where x1 sharp is just x2, x2 sharp is x3, etc. Okay, so that's what we have. So that's the sequential time series. So here's what DMD does. You collect these snapshots into two different matrices. These are the kind of initial points, and then after one time step. And then these DMD modes, before they were eigenvectors of this A matrix in the previous step, but here we just make this A matrix, which is this matrix X sharp times the pseudo-inverse of that matrix. Why does that make sense? Well, we want to have something kind of like, in the language of DMD, we want to write these like x k sharp equals a times x k. Right? We want to sort of have this linear assumption anyway. So if we write this x1 sharp equals a x1, x2 sharp equals a x2, that would be this whole matrix x sharp equals a times x, because x sharp is all these just stacked in columns, and this x is that. So this just says that this is true for every k. So okay, what is a? A you could kind of just multiply by x pseudo inverse and pretend that goes away, and you get this is sort of an approximation of A. So this is a hand-wavy way of seeing it, but that's just a way to see where this comes from. Okay. So in DMD, all you do is you form this matrix of your data and calculate eigenvectors of that matrix and eigenvalues of that matrix. And what I'll show you is that that actually coincides with these DMD modes. And actually, the left eigenvectors of A let you figure out the Koopman eigenfunctions. So the right eigenvectors of A turn out to be these Koopman modes. And the left eigenvectors of A let you figure out at least approximations of these Koopman eigenfunctions.
Excuse me, I missed something I think very basic. When you went from x1 to x2, that wasn't one time step. That was some amount of time. And the difference is
or a
different simulation.
About the same system.
Yeah. So, okay, so x1 to x1 sharp, that's one time step. And x2, now you could think of a...
x2 is a whole bunch of time steps later.
It could be a bunch of time steps later, right? x2 to x2 sharp, or
yeah.
It could be, you know, the first 10 of these are from one simulation, and then you restart your simulation at some other initial condition and go on from there.
Do you really mean one time step later, or you said one...
It could be
any time.
Any time, right. The amount of time is irrelevant, as long as it's the same time. The time between x1 and x1 sharp has to be the same amount of times from x2 to x2 sharp.
Yeah,
okay, so x1 and x1 sharp are more similar than x1 is to x2.
It depends. I mean, and if you take the sequential time series, you could take x2 to equal x1 sharp.
Oh, you could?
Sure. Yeah,
In which case you would get... something that was...
This really the same answer. It's just a special case of this. This is just a bit more general. If you like to think of a sequential time series, just think of this as being x1 through xm, and this is x2 through xm plus 1.
Okay, well, that I'm very used to thinking about. Yeah, okay.
So that's,
all right.
Then just, that's fine.
And for short time step, this is really becoming a derivative. A is really the...
I thought about that, but that's probably right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good... I need to think about that, but I believe you.
I don't see where the difference came in, but okay.
Or through the pseudo inverse, right? Because you're close to 1 plus something.
Yeah.
So A becomes 1 plus the matrix of velocity gradient. Okay, short time.
You won't really get the same answer if it's sequential data versus different data sets unless you have enough sequential data that you're capturing all the behavior.
That's right, yeah. That's right. Yeah, you do need these. So for the theorem that I'll show you that connects DMD with Koopman, you have to have enough data. You have to sample the space appropriately.
Just the basic thing, A is now it's M. The dimension of A is M.
The dimension of this matrix. Oh, okay. So that's actually the dimension of how long you're observable. If you have 100,000 points in your PIV window, this is 100,000 by 100,000.
Yeah, it's big.
So that's quite big. Yeah, but you don't need to compute directly with A either. You can do. For instance, you can use like a
million. M could be million because you start the simulation.
This will end up. The calculation will end up just being based on SVDs of this matrix. Really, you just need to do an SVD of that matrix. That's the only thing you need to do.
In the case, M has to be larger than the dimension of your data.
M?
It doesn't have to be, yeah. There are cases. So I'll tell you, in practice, when we do this, usually, we take these x's not to be literally the velocity at every point, but we first do POD. So these x's are just lists of POD coefficients of that snapshot. And then it's much smaller, right? It's only...
And M is some small number, is it not?
That's the number of snapshots you take. So, like, in our examples, we might start with a flow field which
has...
take
one snapshot?
One snapshot might be 100...
The formula still makes sense?
Only one snapshot.
M equals one.
So there's this issue of overfitting the data. If you have one snapshot, you've got one data point here. There are lots of possible matrices that can map x1 to x1 sharp if you only have that one vector. Right? You have an n-long vector mapping to an n-long vector. That's n equations. You have n squared unknowns. There's many, many possible A's that do that for you. Right, so the more, and you don't want to overfit your data. So it's actually better if M is large, if this matrix X is wider than it is tall.
That will avoid overfitting. You want it to be wider than it is tall.
You want it to be wider than it is tall.
I was imagining it as taller than it was wide.
Yeah, if it's taller than it is wide, you'll still get an answer. You'll still get these modes. And everything works fine. And actually, often that is the case if you have 100,000 points of observation and only 100 snapshots. Mm-hmm. Well, then it'll be much taller.
Yeah.
But in that case, it's actually, you'll get better numerical results. Okay. If you first take all these snapshots and do POD and find the dominant POD mode, so you only keep the first maybe 50 POD modes, and you have 100 snapshots, and then you'll get actually a more reliable, noise-free answer.
So you project each X onto the POD modes after you do a POD of the full big X matrix.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So then these X's are not literally velocities of points, they're just POD coefficients.
But it could be any observable.
They could be any observables, right. They could be these point measurements, they could be POD coefficients. So you could think of POD coefficients as being an observable. Right? It takes a velocity field, gives you, the coefficient of the second POD mode. That's an observable. Yeah, so I think of these vectors X as being vectors of observables. Okay. So once you have that, this computation is pretty standard linear algebra. It still seems to be that we need to assume the dynamics are linear, right? We still assume that X sharp is A times X. So that's maybe disturbing, but that's where the Koopman operator comes in. So this is what Igor talked about. If this map from these observables X to X sharp comes from this dynamical system, Z mapping to T of Z, there's the Koopman operator. That's why eigenfunctions might be useful. They give you good coordinates. So here's how Koopman is related to DMD. So let's say we have a set of these observables, psi j. So we have n of these functions. So that could be n point measurements of velocity. It could be n coefficients of POD modes, whatever observable you like. So that's the high-level universal picture that John was talking about. And now we take a set of initial states. So these are the initial conditions. We're going to evolve each of these one step through the dynamics. So we'll start with z1, and we'll get t of z1. And we'll make these vectors of all, so xk is a vector of all the observables at this initial state, zk. xk sharp is the vector of all the observables at the next step. Okay, so that's the data. Really, it's the same idea we were considering before, where these are the initial kind of velocity field, and that was the velocity field of the next step. We just have a vector of observables. And we define those matrices as before, the A matrix as before. Then here's this theorem that connects these. So if phi is an eigenfunction of u, and its eigenvalue is lambda, and if phi is in the span of these observables, now this is a big assumption, because usually these phis might be complicated. We don't know if it's in the span of these observables. So this is an assumption that's difficult to achieve and difficult to verify, but it's what we're making here. That means that we can write phi as a linear combination of these elements of the vector psi. And that's just a way of writing that. Think of that as a row vector w star times a column vector psi of all these observables. So that's a linear combination of these observables. Then if there's an assumption on how much data you have, this is saying that you need to sample the space enough, then if this was an eigenfunction of phi, then w is going to be a left eigenvector of A with eigenvalue lambda. In other words, you can reconstruct this eigenfunction just by finding a left eigenvector of A, w, and or w star, and lambda is the Koopman eigenvalue, and this is the Koopman eigenfunction. So this lets you find the Koopman eigenfunction from the matrix A.
In practice, can you sort of test the span thing by increasing your amount of data and seeing if you get the same modes coming out?
You pretty much can. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. I might even have some slides in here where we do that. Yeah, so that's what we sometimes do is we split the data. We segregate it into some training data and then some testing data. And we can do this on the training data and then apply it to the testing data and see whether it still is an eigenvalue, still is an eigenfunction. And if it's not, then oops, you know, this must have been not very true, or right, not true. And if it does work, then okay, that maybe it's a good eigenfunction. Okay, so the Koopman eigenvalues are DMD eigenvalues as long as these two things hold. And this one is difficult and often is not true. This one is easy. If it's not true, you just gather more data.
What's R of X?
Sponsor, just the range, the column space. Okay. Yeah, the span of the columns of X.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe that's all I need to say. Well, I think it's useful doing this little example, because there are there are a lot of people who are applying this DMD method and just saying, okay, so this is equals to Koopman, and it's really not. I mean, you need to be careful. It's not that simple, and so it's common to take this full state observable, and this is something Igor mentioned too, right? It's common to take the observable to be, say, the whole velocity field. But that typically does not work for a nonlinear system. Doing DMD with that observable typically does not work. And here's a very simple example that shows this. So here's just a map in two dimensions. So we have the state space is two real numbers, z1 and z2. And z1 maps to lambda z1, z2 maps to mu z2, plus this quadratic thing. Okay, so c is just a parameter, lambda and mu are parameters. So if you look at this for a moment, you realize that, first of all, there's an equilibrium at the origin of z1 and z2 are 0, 0 maps to 0, and then there are these invariant manifolds. If you start on the vertical axis with z1 equals 0, well, z1 always stays 0, right, because 0 will map to 0. So this vertical axis is an invariant manifold, and there's also an invariant manifold that's this parabola, z2 equals c z1 squared. Just plug that in, and you'll see that's also holds. So it turns out those are zero-level sets. This is something Igor referred to of Koopman eigenfunctions for this system. So if you look at these functions, these two functions are Koopman eigenfunctions with eigenvalues lambda and mu. Okay, if you like, the level sets of these eigenfunctions I've drawn as these gray lines. So the level sets of this phi lambda are the vertical lines, and level sets of phi mu are the gray lines. So a way to think of these Koopman eigenfunctions, one way to think of them is they give you, if you have a sort of a full set of eigenfunctions, then they give you good coordinates on which to write your system, in which the dynamics will just be linear. So this will just, if you use these coordinates, then the dynamics will be linear, just z1 maps to lambda z1, z2 maps to mu z2, if you switch to these coordinates. Okay, so we have these Koopman eigenfunctions. Can we calculate these from data, from just DMD? So let's try it with the full state observable. Okay, there was this parameter C, and I should have pointed out that if C was 0, then everything was linear. That's C. So if that's 0, then all the quadratic term goes away, and you just get a linear system. And if that's 0, and you do DMD on this, what does that mean? Well, you take these observables, I plug in these initial points and propagate those one times one step through the map. And that gives me my two matrices, X and X sharp. If C is 0, then the DMD eigenvalues are exactly lambda and mu that I started with. So it works beautifully. I get those eigenvalues. I even get the eigenfunctions perfect. But if C is 1, so now it does have the quadratic terms are now there, then the DMD eigenvalues are 0.9. That was the vertical one, and 2.002, which is way off the 0.5. In fact, this is terrible because if these eigenvalues have magnitude less than 1, it's of course stable, and bigger than 1, it's unstable. So we think, oops, we have an unstable system here. So this does not correspond to any Koopman eigenvalue. You'd even get the wrong stability answer for this very simple nonlinear system. So how can you fix this? Well, let's remember in the theorem we needed the observable or the eigenfunction to be in the span of the observables. So now the observables here are z1 and z2. Well, What are the eigenfunctions? That is in the span of the observables. That's why we got that one right. But this is not in the span of the observables. That's not z2 plus something z1, right? There's a z1 squared. So what we need to do to make DMD work well is take a third observable, which is z1 squared. Now this might seem crazy because, okay, if I measure z1 and I measure z2, that's everything. Measuring z1 squared is just redundant, right? But what this says is I need to do that to have that observable in my set of basis functions. I view this as a set of basis functions on which to expand this. And if I do that, then I get these DMD eigenvalues are exactly right. 0.9, 0.5, that's lambda mu, and this one is lambda squared. Yeah.
If you were to write the equations for these three coordinates, then you would have a linear system.
You would, that's right. Exactly right.
That's why you're just finding eigenfunctions.
And you're finding that linear system. Exactly, you're finding that matrix that relates those, finding its eigenvalues, and it works perfectly. Yeah. But if the eigenfunction is not in that span, then you'll generate more functions. Like here, when you did this, when you put this through the map, this would generate a z1 squared that's not in the system. So you sort of leave the... You're trying to project this onto a function space spanned by these two functions, z1, phi of z equals z1, and phi of z equals z2. And when you apply the Koopman operator, you leave that subspace. Here, the subspace is now invariant. Right? You stay in the subspace. And that's a really difficult thing to check. But if you do have that case. Okay, so if we were just naive and picked a third function z2 squared, well now, since we know the secret, why this worked, we know this is not going to work. But if you do that, you can't just naively add more functions. Now you get this other crazy eigenvalue, which is meaningless.
But if you had z1 squared in there as well.
If you had z1 squared in as well, then it would work perfectly. That's right. Yeah.
If you were to add c1 squared, what eigenvalue would you get for c2? 0 or?
This z2 squared, okay, so that's a good question. Not exactly sure. Of course, there's going to be a Koopman eigenfunction. So powers of these, as Igor pointed out, are also eigenfunctions. Mm-hmm. So you get this phi mu squared is also going to be eigenfunction. So that'll have a z2 squared in it. But that won't be invariant. That'll leave our subspace because it'll have a z1 to the fourth, which is not in our subspace. And it'll have a z1 squared times z2, which is also not in our subspace.
So then could you provoke getting an eigenvalue larger than 1 by making your subspace too big?
You might, yeah. I'm not sure about that, but I think you would. However, I will say that if you do include these extraneous basis functions, in a sense, it won't prevent you from calculating the valid. It won't prevent you from calculating these, because these are still in the span of your observables that you're considering. But you'll just have more extraneous ones that might be wrong.
But then you might think that you have certain modes that are not actually physically meaningful.
You might, yeah, yeah.
How do you know what observables to try, and how do you know there are finitely many of them that are important?
Really hard question. A lot of the art in this is trying good observables.
You just try it. So it's like the nonlinear system ID people who just have a toolbox of...
Yeah. I mean, I can give you examples. So examples are like Fourier coefficients are good observables. We've done a lot of examples using radial basis functions. So if you have, very points in space, take radial basis functions centered around your points in space. That tends to work well. But there are lots of, you can do spectral elements, right? So you can have a combination of kind of, so another one is Ulam's method. Grid up your whole phase space into tiny little boxes and take these basis functions to be indicator functions on those tiny little boxes. So they're either 1 or 0, depending on whether your point's in the box or not. Or spectral elements are kind of a combination of that with spectral methods. So we've tried all these cases. You can also take, of course, these delays. So pick one observable, and then the vector of observables is that observable at this time, and at the previous time, and the previous time, like that. This is the Tokens embedding that Igor mentioned. And this is exactly this function space of expanding f, u, f, v squared, f, that Igor mentioned.
Yeah,
So, lots of choices. Yeah.
So you've answered the questions now. That actually, so my, you, what you're saying is, to compute an eigenfunction, what you have to do is construct a basis that you suspect is going to, you know, span wherever the eigenfunction you're interested in. So
yes.
Then when I say, oh, I'm interested in vorticity, now I got to construct a basis that's going to, that I hope is going to span the eigenfunctions of vorticity, which.
Yeah.
And so you kind of change the problem. Now
just a small correction.
Okay.
Eigenfunctions are universal.
Okay.
They're not associated with observable.
Yeah.
So whatever observable he takes is.
I thought
of the Koopman, but the DMD are, and so that when he chose different observables,
the terminology, right? Eigenvalues and eigenfunctions are universal. Eigenmodes are not. They are associated with observables. It's just a terminological issue. Eigenmodes are projections of observable onto eigenfunctions. Eigenfunctions and eigenvalues are universal.
Eigenmodes are projections of the. Maybe you're going to tell us about
Yeah, well, I could write that down for you. Let's see, I need to pick some notation. It's not going to be totally confusing. Let's say that. I think G is what Eagle was using for a vector of things you're interested in. Okay, so G of X, here X is the state space, so let me stick with that notation.
Well, he was using Z for the state space
before.
Okay, so we say Z. Okay, G of Z. Well, this is going to end up being Igor's expansion. So let's just say it's sum over J of, so each component of G, let's say we can expand in eigenfunctions, right? So let's say G, the first component of G, let's write this as some expansion, we'll call it V1 times VJ, V1J. Okay, so I just expand the first component of G is a function of Z, right? So I'll expand it in these let's assume that there's a full set of eigenfunctions. Might not be true, but let's say it is, right? Okay, now we can do this also for the kth component. So for each, now let's write this as the whole vector G of Z is the sum of J of this vector VJ, VJ of Z, right? So this is what we call the Koopman mode. Associated with G, dependent on G. And this is the Koopman eigenfunction.
So the modes are really the coefficients in Igor's expansion.
The coefficients, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And this depends on G. Go back to what G is again. Sorry.
G is just the vector of things you care about. For you, it's vorticity. You take vector.
So then the problem is, okay, we need to generate a basis that we hope is going to span a set of eigenfunctions which are complete enough over here to expand the things we care about.
Right, yeah.
I imagine there's a huge, non-trivial, because you don't know what the eigenfunctions are.
Exactly, yeah.
And just getting a span, and like in this, in the example you've shown us, you've actually increased the dimensionality of the span.
Yes.
That you're,
bigger than the state space.
Bigger than the state space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in general, if you want to represent a nonlinear system by a linear system, you have to do that.
Exactly. Yes. Right. Sure. That's a great way of thinking about it. This nonlinear system can be represented by a 3x3 linear system, where the three variables are z1, z2, and z1 squared. Right. It could also be a 2x2 linear system of these are the coordinates, but that's a funny.
Now, I guess you're going to go further. With, doesn't that mean you have to know everything before you use this to analyze anything?
In a way, it sort of does. I mean, you don't have to know everything, but it's a really, I mean, to do this kind of rigorously for a high-dimensional system like fluids is, I don't think you can really do it rigorously. You're just replacing a lot of faith that this DMD method is going to somehow...
But you say you can't do it rigorously, but it sounds as though you can't do it at all. Those eigenvalues were completely off.
Yeah, even for this 2x2 system. Right, if nonlinearities are present, this is, you're on very thin ice with this method. I totally...
So you're on no ice. But,
yeah.
And yet you guys find it useful. That must not be true.
What's the problem?
Let me offer an analogy, right? This is the same as saying, because I have to take an infinite number of Fourier functions to capture the whole evolution of Navier-Stokes, it doesn't make sense to do it with 350.
Yes, no, but we know.
Actually, let me address this point. So this is this.
No, because that we know the answer.
I want to jump. So here, me, I compute periodic orbits and equilibria and heteroclinic connections of Navier-Stokes, and I'm totally happy saying I'm going to truncate my Fourier expansions like this. But so I know how to compute those things, and I know how to compute them to arbitrary precision, and that gives me, you know, a periodic orbit is an eigen, as an exact eigen. You know, pushing aside modulo that truncation, it's an eigenfunction of Perron-Frobenius operator, and it's exact.
Pushing aside the truncation.
Pushing aside
the truncation,
but...
From the perspective of an approach is the same thing. It's applied mathematics. You take a finite basis and you hope for the best.
Okay, but the way I'm doing it, I actually get an exact periodic orbit up to that truncation. This is saying, okay, I'm going to have finite representation of the dynamics, which is that truncation of Fourier mode. And now you're telling me to go off and create a basis to expand these eigenfunctions, where, you know, which could be larger dimensional than the truncation of the Fourier mode stacks. Here we're having problems in two dimensions, knowing what the expansion function is, what the right basis is. So I'm not convinced that this is I haven't seen yet.
I have to say, John, I totally agree with you. And what people in fluids who apply this do is exactly this. They say, let's assume we'll take the whole state. That must capture everything. Let's do DMD. We get these eigenvalues. Okay, in that case it was linear, we got the correct answer. Good, if it's linear, we're guaranteed to get the correct answer. But in reality, fluids is non-linear, so they get these eigenvalues and they try to make sense of this. And some of these might by chance be good. Others might be nonsense. And a lot of people are just applying this method and saying, aha, DMD equals Koopman, I found these eigenvalues, aha, when it's meaningless. I totally agree with that, yeah.
There are two statements here. Mm-hmm. There is a theorem that just tells you if you take all the polynomials, you're going to get the result. That's on the same basis as what you're talking about. What Clancy is talking about is the practice of just taking the state and hoping for the best. Well, that's blind hope. Right? That's really blind hope, as he's showing very, very, very precisely.
If you had U and U.grad U, you do have everything. You've done effectively your same linearization.
Is it in that statement you're saying all the polynomials of the coefficients of the spectral expansion, right?
Yes,
you're starting out with, let's start with 100,000 or a million coefficients, and now let's generate all the polynomials up to, say, 15th order of those things.
The 15th polynomial decays like lambda to the power of 15. If that's not good enough for you, that's fine with me, but it's good enough for me.
Okay, well,
do I want to say something? Yeah,
it's exponential decay of higher order terms. I don't know what else to say.
But no, I'm not sure I agree with this decay, because that might be in the basis function.
So
it might be.
If you take, you know, 3 million polynomials, I believe it's on the same grounds as doing any numerical analysis, which is, this is an infinite dimensional operator. You need an infinite basis to capture all of its properties. There is no doubt about it.
Yep.
The name of the game is, can you prove that under, and this I agree with you, can you prove that under finite truncations, you are getting a good result? And for a pretty large class of systems, those kinds of things exist. That's all I'm saying.
Well, my point was just
if you pick the appropriate basis, like, so if you try to pick the Fourier basis functions, you may get better answers in that case as well.
That to me is a very nice question in numerical methods for these kinds of problems. And one has to start looking at, what the periodic expansion method numerical analysis looked like 15 years ago, and one has to look at what numerical analysis of Navier-Stokes looked like 15 years ago. And when you take a look at, for example, what Clancy and people at Princeton and people at the University of Washington have done, I think the progress has been done extremely rapid, plus theorems, right? So, I mean, of course, we're at the state that we are at.
I want to understand what people are doing with this. That is to say, I mean, having done this, you could just think of PODs. We didn't actually get dynamics out of POD. You could have done directly, but you used this as a basis to get a low-dimensional projection. And once you have those basis functions, you did a Galerkin projection onto those modes.
In which case,
all these issues are.
I actually have some slides that speak to that. If you want, I can show you two slides that have a very nice example of that. You want me to do it? No, Clancy.
Well, maybe after Clancy. I just wanted to verify.
I'm just trying to understand what it is that people want to do with. I mean, are you trying to get the dynamics out of this, or are you trying to go back to Navier-Stokes? Are you going to go back to Navier-Stokes and get the dynamics that way?
The short answer is all of the above. So the projection, if you're asking about the projection, I'll show you a very nice normal form that captures the dynamics of the oscillating cylinder beautifully with 1.5 degree of freedom, 1.5 dimension projection, right? And non-linear in that case, because you take a basis, which is the Koopman mode and the bifurcation point. So if you want to do projections, you can do projections. If you want to do what Denise is saying, and okay, I have some noise, that's the continuous spectrum issue. I think there are many different facets of what people want to do.
So my answer would be that a lot of people are taking these Koopman modes and treating them just like POD modes.
Yeah.
They're looking at, they're plotting them and trying to get a sense for coherent structures. You know, if this has an eigenvalue e to the i omega, then they say, okay, well, that's something that's a structure that's evolving with that frequency, right? And that's a nice, useful decomposition because I've decomposed the structures in the flow by frequency. They're not orthogonal though, so that's worse than POD.
But they're decoupled by frequency, so that might be of interest for whatever reason.
Yeah, and that's how a lot of people are using it. And then, by the way, it gets to be very similar to just a Fourier transform in time. Just take the discrete Fourier transform in time, and that's essentially what those modes VJ are for many flows. Yeah, Joe.
In a really practical sense, relative to what you just said, how do folks who do this with experimental data, and then they look at these, how do they know how many modes to keep?
Really hard question, actually. Because what you get is these plots of these eigenvalues of this matrix A, and they're everywhere. They're like everywhere on the unit circle. So what are the most important ones? There are some, I think my favorite method is this thing, sparsity promoting DMD, which was by Mihailo Jovanovic, and I think Peter Schmidt was involved in this at CTR. Where they say, okay, we're going to look for a set of these modes, VJ, that explain the data, that sort of span the data closely, but I'm going to penalize how many modes I need to keep. So I'm going to promote sparsity in this. And then those modes tend to be important ones.
So that seems conceptually quite different from what people do with POD, where they basically say, how much energy am I capturing?
Very different.
And the sparsity promoting one isn't always the best way to truncate a model.
True, yeah.
It's very nice, but for a particular application, but if you want to make sort of a low order model, that doesn't always work very well.
Yeah.
So Dimitris Drinakis at Courant has a method in which he penalizes the gradient of the resulting modes, which is kind of interesting because if you think,
what?
Giannakis, he's actually going to be here visiting my lab in a week. So.
Okay.
He's a mathematician at Courant, and he came up with this idea of penalizing the gradients. You think about it, it makes a lot of sense. If you have an extremely oscillatory mode, well, you know, average over it and throw it away. He's had some really nice results.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe I'll just show a couple of examples here. This is extended DMD, but I'm going to... Okay, I'll show this Duffing equation to show you the kind of thing that you can do with this. And this sort of gets at the White's question of what do you do with these modes once you find them. So again, very low dimensional system, right? A scalar ODE, second order ODE, that's nonlinear. And we can compute this DMD. Just think of EDMD as I'm keeping extra basis functions, those nonlinear basis functions. And we take a bunch of trajectories, so we take 1,000 trajectories, each of which is 11 samples long. So I just solve this ODE for 1,000 different initial conditions, each of which is with 10 samples, 10 time steps. And these basis functions are radial basis functions. So what we do here is we take all that data, we cluster the data into 1,000 clusters, take the centers of those clusters, or a representative point in those clusters. Those are the centers of the radial basis function. And we expand in that set. So we hope that that's going to give a basis for a function space. And we do DMD on this. And here's an eigenvalue close to zero. And this is the constant function, which is boring. Igor mentioned that you always get an eigenvalue zero, which is the constant function. Then we get this one that's very close to zero. And that gives you two basins of attraction. So here's this eigenfunction. And it's pretty much constant on this set and pretty much constant on that set and zero in between. So this is like an indicator function showing you which basin you're in. And of course, if you're in this basin, you never leave the basin. So if you're blue, you'll always stay blue. So your value will never change. So that eigenvalue should be close to zero. The only reason it's not exactly zero is that some of these points are really on the border and might go the wrong way. So here's the actual data points that we used, colored by which, by the value of that eigenfunction. And if we say, okay, the red points should go to that equilibrium, the blue points should go to that one, this is just showing the points that we mislabel by our eigenfunction. So we can, okay, so what this, one thing this eigenfunction let us do was take a point in state space and tell you which equilibrium it's going to go to. Okay, so help understand the dynamical system.
And you'd know that without an a priori knowledge of the Duffing equation. You'd know that those are basins of attraction from...
Right, just from data.
Just from
data. Yeah, so we got these eigenfunctions just from data, this EDMD, right? Yep.
So you were mentioning that this is the first one is boring in this particular application.
Yeah,
but
constant, yeah.
Is this a good way to maybe calculate the mean of something? Say if you don't have... You know, sometimes when you're doing POD, figuring out what the appropriate mean is very difficult.
Yeah,
would this be
yep.
a good way to get at that mean?
Yeah, this eigenfunction is just the constant. It's literally the constant function. It takes any point in state space and gives you back the same number. So that really is boring. But the corresponding mode would be the mean at vj.
In the spatially extended case, yeah. Exactly right.
Yeah.
Could you just spell out a little bit the 1,000 radial basis function? So the what the observable was, or what the x's were.
Yeah.
In terms of your A matrix and where you started out with x and x sharp, what were those, and what were the radial basis functions on top of those?
Let me try to make sure I see if I can get this right, because this is Matt Williams, by the way, who did this. But, okay, so what he did, we have all these data points like this, and we cluster these into, we pick 1,000 radial basis, so there are 1,000 points here, which are denser where the points are denser, and we represent any function here as a sum of these radial basis functions, and the way that, actually, we use these thin plate splines, which are funny because they're not local. They don't have just local support. They have global support. But we represent any function as a linear combination of 1,000 of these radial basis functions with different centers along here.
Okay, so that's the expansion basis for
that's the expansion,
eigenfunctions.
Yeah. So you can represent pretty complicated functions with that.
And then so then the matrix you ended up with, what were the X's? What are the things, the X's that generated the A matrix?
They were the coefficients of each of these 1,000 radial basis functions. Yeah.
So the A matrix is 1,000 by 1,000?
It'd be 1,000 by 1,000, yeah.
The matrix is 1,000 by 1,000. And So you wrote those eigenfunctions, so each of them is a length thousand.
Yeah, I mean, the function would be you take those thousand coefficients of these basis functions, and that gives you the actual.
And those are all.
And then you could write them in X space or something.
In X space, yeah.
And X dot space, right?
Yes.
That's the word. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what are we seeing below? I mean, formal terms.
Okay, so this is the value of the Koopman eigenfunction corresponding to this eigenvalue. So it's pretty much constant. I don't know what the value is.
Yeah.
This is, let's
say,
so it's minus
one value here,
one.
One value there. That's the lambda. That's phi one.
That's phi one. Yes, of x comma y.
It's made up of its when you reinterpret those thousand basic coefficients in real space.
Right. Yeah.
And the constant one, the first one.
Yeah, not what, one.
So it would just be.
Just be all blue. Yeah.
And what's its? What does it mean? It doesn't matter, I guess.
So the constant function is always going to be an eigenfunction of the Koopman operator. Why is that? Because if you have if a function f of z is a constant for every z, then f of tz also equals f of z.
Okay, but we should think of it as a trivial one, like
it's trivial. It's completely
like
trivial.
Okay, and the other two things are not eigenfunctions. They are ways to think about what's happening in the Duffing equation and how to relate it to the.
This is almost the same. All I've done here is I've taken the actual points here and colored them by the value of the eigenfunction at that point.
So those are trajectories?
These are, or sample points, yep.
They're sample points, and the trajectories, and you've colored them. Backwards?
Oh, yeah, I guess backwards.
Yeah,
yeah, sorry about that.
Okay.
Sorry.
okay.
Oops.
So that eigenfunction, that lambda 1 eigenfunction, has values that are blue and red and green.
Yes.
It's mm-hmm. not exactly constant. No, it's
right.
constant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because these ones on the separatrix are tricky.
Okay, and what you've shown us in the third one, I understand it's the green points, but what's its relationship with if you're in the language of eigenfunctions?
The only thing I was plotting here, these were actual sample points that went to the wrong basin of attraction. So what I was trying to do here is, if you give me a starting point, I want to be able to tell you which basin it's going to go to, this basin or that basin.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I'm going to do that is I have this eigenfunction that I calculated from data previously collected. And I'm going to evaluate my eigenfunction. If it's less than zero, if it's blue, I say you go to this basin. If it's greater than zero, you go to this basin. And some of these are really on the borderline because green was right around zero. And those are the ones that are misclassified.
Yeah, I just wanted to understand in the language of the eigenfunction.
You got the sign of the eigenvalue wrong.
It's pretty close to zero.
The eigenfunctions are trying to approximate that basin boundary, but he's doing it numerically with a bunch of radial basis functions, so it's approximate. And that's like the error of the boundary.
But,
it is approximate.
But that thing there requires knowledge that is outside these computations. It's because you know about Duffing and you know where it is.
In order to get this? Or
yes.
Yeah.
That's
this actually ran those points
the
all the way and then looked at what basin they did end up in. Yeah. Yeah.
So is the next eigenvalue down well separated from zero? The next eigenvalue?
I will show you the next eigenvalue. Yeah, it's interesting. So. Okay, so here's another pair of eigenfunctions. So you get a complex pair. And this is the magnitude of that eigenfunction, magnitude of phi 2, and this is the argument, the phase of that eigenfunction. And what you see is it really parameterizes this basin. So if you project onto, if you were to take the value of this eigenfunction as a coordinate, a complex coordinate, then the magnitude of that number would tell you, which level set here you're on, how far away from the equilibrium you are, and the phase would tell you where you are there.
Question?
This would be a good coordinate to use for Duffing, because in fact, in those coordinates, it's linear. The equation is just that coordinate equals lambda 2 times, or the coordinate at the next step equals lambda 2 times the coordinate at this step.
Right. I'm sorry, can we go back to the previous one?
Sure.
And this is awful. I'm going to basically ask the same question because I didn't understand the answer the first time.
Uh-huh.
In the first picture there on the left, you get your eigenfunction.
Yes.
And it's a shape. Is that, am I okay so far? How do you know that that shape delineates a basin of attraction? Without having some a priori knowledge of Duffing's equation.
Yeah, yeah, okay, because this eigenvalue tells you what the dynamics are like of that eigenfunction. And it tells you that it's almost invariant, it doesn't change much at all. It's minus 10 to the minus 3, that's very close to zero. So if I look at
the dynamics are very similar.
That means that blue stays in blue, doesn't change at all, red stays in blue.
Okay, all right, good, thank you.
Okay, so maybe we should stop. The point was these other eigenfunctions tell you about the dynamics within the basins. Is that a good stopping point? That's getting late.
Yeah. Probably a good idea to stop because there's a finite brain capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.